Business and Economic Development to order. Welcome, everybody, on this beautiful Tuesday afternoon. We're going to start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 207, and I'll ask that Senator Vicki Walker come forward.
And can I ask that Amelia come up, too?
You may ask that.
But I'm not beating up on him.
So you're here voluntarily, huh? Senator, have a drug you here.
There's only one answer to that question, I think.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Kevin Neely for the record, Oregon Department of Justice. I'm the assistant to the Attorney General. The Department of Justice is bringing forward Senate Bill 207. I'm here to testify in support of that bill. Quite simply, what this bill does is it requires insurance companies, certain kinds of insurance companies, to receive a return receipt when they have canceled or terminated a insurance policy. The purpose behind this bill is in those instances in which a customer has signed up for electronic notification. We think that's obviously a fantastic thing, and it's good that customers have the ability to do that discretionarily. But when it comes to the end of the line and they're about to lose their insurance, particularly their auto insurance, we believe that the best thing for consumers is to be sure that they have clearly understood that their insurance is about to be canceled. That way, if they want to take any remunerative action, they have the ability to do that, hopefully, before they're out on the roads and they get in a wreck. This bill was brought to us by Senator Walker. We've discussed the bill with the Insurance Commission, and again, they have worked closely with us in trying to find a way to address what we think is a very small and specific issue here, and that's only that final step, the actual termination. And so the way the process would work is if, in fact, an insurance company was going to terminate your auto insurance, for example, they would send you the electronic notification, as they're authorized to do under UEDA. And if they were to receive a return receipt on that email, it'd be done. They could go on with their business as normal. If they didn't receive that return receipt, they would simply have to put a written letter into the U.S. mail, drop it in the mailbox, send it off to the customer. That letter would be the cancellation letter. That's how traditionally the system worked, as I understand it. I've been told that by the Insurance Commission. And as soon as they send that out, doesn't need to be certified, just needs to have a stamp on it, then they can go ahead and continue with the cancellation of the policy. So this would just add one extra step in those instances in which the insured did not proactively alert the insurer that they had gotten that email. We think it's a very good thing for consumers. We think particularly for those individuals on the road who get hit by a consumer or get in a wreck with a consumer that may have had their policy canceled and not been, we think, notified in a way that allowed them to take any action. So with that, I'll pass it on to Senator Walker. She can give you some of the details as to why she was interested in this bill, and I'd appreciate your support.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. A lot of times we bring bills forward because of constituents or because of experiences we have had, and I'm Senator Vicki Walker from Eugene District 7. This happened to, the bill idea came from an experience I had. On October 5th of 2003, I was involved in a very serious auto accident in Las Vegas, Nevada. I was a passenger in an automobile driven by my daughter's boyfriend, and my daughter was in the front seat. A phantom vehicle, they call it phantom because we were not able to identify the license plate number on this vehicle, attempted to run us off the road because they didn't see us there. We ended up going horizontally across four lanes of traffic coming at us, going at least 70 miles an hour. Las Vegas, they drive fast in Las Vegas. Their posted speeds for their urban downtown cores, like 70 miles an hour. And we ended up on the other side, lucky, very lucky to be alive. The police came, we got home, and my daughter's boyfriend was looking for his insurance papers, and he couldn't find the most recent one. And the next day, the reality hit. This young man had agreed to contract with his insurance company by email, American Family Insurance. All of his transactions were by email. Unbeknownst to this young man, who finds it a very serious issue to be uninsured. He found out that he had been canceled by his insurance company by email. They had notified him about five occasions, but this guy did not get his email. Now, there are a lot of reasons that you don't get your email. One, you're not checking it. Two, it could go in your spam filter. Or three, you could have a computer crash. Or there are a number of reasons why you cannot rely on the accuracy of email. In fact, the United States Bankruptcy Court has changed to electronic filing. And this, I brought this same issue up with the court, saying that you have to have a confirmation that someone's case has been filed. Otherwise, how are they ever going to know it's been filed? So this young man's insurance had been canceled. He did not know it. We then were in this car accident. His car was totaled with $15,000 damage. He was uninsured. I was injured. My daughter was injured. And guess who picked up the tab? My own insurance company had to pay for my injuries, my daughter's injuries, and any settlement that we received therefrom because he was uninsured. He did not ask to be uninsured. He did not want to be uninsured, and the insurance company left him that way because they canceled him by email. Now, let me give you a little bit of background about the Uniform Electronic Transaction Act, otherwise known as UETA. Congress, and I learned all this after the accident when I couldn't believe that he'd been canceled. Congress passed UETA in 1999. When it passed UETA, they specifically exempted property, health and life insurance from being canceled by email. So if you have a health insurance policy or life insurance policy and you agree to do business with the insurance company by email, they can't cancel you by email under federal UETA. Oregon adopted UETA in 2001. With just as is, I was not very smart then. I didn't know what was to lie ahead. But in 2001, we adopted UETA as it was. So Oregon then allowed people to contract business by electronic mail. But again, property and casualty insurance did not get the exemption, and anyone who had a property or casualty insurance policy could be canceled by email. It's a very simple fix. I contacted Gail Hillebrand at the Consumers Union out of San Francisco, California. She told me they lobbied hard for Congress not to allow this exclusion, that all insurances should not be able to be canceled by email. Congress ignored those pleas, and what happened to my daughter's boyfriend is exactly what we predicted would happen. So this is a very simple fix. It is absolutely easy to do. If you can send an email out with a return receipt notice. I'm sure you've gotten those yourself. I have a friend who does that routinely. It annoys me, but she at least knows that I've read her email. I can turn it off so that I don't send the return receipt. If that happens, the insurance company will have to send me out a paper form. There are just too many ways for people's email to get lost. I explained how that can happen. I don't think that the cancellation of a policy should rest on receipt of an email, even though you've agreed to transact your business by electronic mail. I talked to Joel Ario, the insurance commission, yesterday. Can you give me an estimate of how many uninsured drivers we have in this state? He said it's pretty hard to do because they're not going to stand up and say, yeah, I'm an uninsured driver. But he estimates about 10%. We don't need to add to that problem. This accident could have been a heck of a lot worse had we hit someone. Frankly, we should have been dead, and we should have killed other people. This was such a serious accident. And it was very traumatizing for me emotionally and physically. So I had to go to my own insurance company to cover all of those plans, and that isn't the way it's supposed to be. So that's why I'm asking for this change. It's a simple fix. I think you have a letter in your file from the property casualty insurers who don't like this because it's one more layer and people already agreed to transact by email. But frankly, this is good policy. And when you cancel someone's insurance, they need to know about it, and you need to take some great care to do that. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm available for questions.
I have a question for either one of you. You know, I'm not very good at computers, so
Well, that's another reason, Mr. Chair.
But explain that to me in terms of a return receipt. What does that mean? When I open an email, at least on certain servers, other people know that I've already opened that email, just the fact that I opened it. So, but what is a return receipt?
It's a little blurb that comes up on the email. It'll just come up on the screen, and it'll say the sender requires you to acknowledge that you received the email, and you have to click on yes or click on no. And I've gotten those before and clicked on no because I don't want somebody to know I've read their email just yet, because then they're going to want a response right away. Mm-hmm. But that's what that is.
Okay.
It just clicks up on your server. But as you admitted yourself, you don't know computers very well, and maybe this person who agrees to contract by email does, but there are still so many things that can get in the way.
Okay, I'm curious, back to your accident situation. Now, this young man's insurance had been canceled, or at least attempted to be canceled, I guess in this case it was, by email. So why was he canceled in this particular case?
It was up for renewal.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't pay the fee to renew because he didn't get his email that it was up for renewal. They cannot cancel you.
So he was billed by email as well.
Yeah, yeah. And I have since cautioned him and my daughter never to do business by email. I just don't like it. I want the paper in my hand. But yeah, it was a renewal because they can't cancel you midterm for failure to pay, but they could cancel him on renewal.
I see.
And so it was his renewal period. And also, you know, he travels a lot. He's a helicopter pilot and he travels a lot. And so he probably wasn't home when his email came in and he moved a lot. And, you know, there's all kinds of different reasons why it happened, but he's not the first person this could happen to. And it really puts a burden on our society when we have people wandering around without insurance. And, you know, it could be your house. The property and casualty insurance could be your house. What if your house burns down and you got canceled by email and you didn't know it? You don't have a house and you don't have coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So I frankly don't know why Congress allowed the exemption for health and life insurance policy and not the other two. It doesn't make sense, and I'm going to lobby Congress to put that back in. In the meantime, I'll go state by state. Starting with my own.
Well, good. I'm glad you're starting here. See, I have the exact opposite problem, Senator. I don't have the email notification. I have my insurance company always sends me renewals like 2 or 3 months in advance, and then they're old by the time I remember I'm supposed to pay them. Questions by the committee? No questions.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Would anybody else like to testify on Senate Bill 207 at this time? Keep it in mind, you probably will not have an opportunity to testify on it again. So if you do, now, there's some people here, you know, don't come see me in my office if you don't want to testify today. Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 207. And we will, let's see, do we have Senator Ringo isn't here at the moment. Correcto mundo. So, should we go to 151?
Yeah.
All right, let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 151. And let's ask Neil Jackson to come forward, please.
Make it fine to come to your return receipt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 151. What I've done is what we call a deck sheet, what I've got in front of me, and you've probably seen
these. Please identify yourself.
Neil Jackson. I'm here to testify on 151. I am a member of the Board of Governors of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association.
Okay, thank you.
What I've got in front of me is what your declaration sheet looks like on your auto policy or something similar. And the reason I put this up is we're dealing with just Senate Bill 151 deals with one section, which is the personal injury protection limits. Presently in Oregon, the legislature last session raised the PIP limits to $15,000 from $10,000. PIP is what your company pays to pay your medical bills, pay your wage loss. If you were killed in an accident, they would pay a funeral payment to you, currently $2,500. If you had children and you had to get a babysitter, your insurance would pay up to $15 a day for a babysitter to take care of your children while you were injured and unable to do that yourself. What Senate Bill 151 does is increases the specific amount of payments. It doesn't increase the overall limits of $15,000. That stays the same. But what it does is, I think, brings more into line with the current expenses of living. My research indicates the last time these numbers were changed was in the mid-80s, 1983 to be specific. What the first section of the bill changes from a maximum of $1,250 per month wage replacement to $3,500 per month. That doesn't mean that every person would receive $3,500 per month, because there's a limitation in the statute currently where the person receives up to 70% of the wages they were earning before they were injured and unable to work because of the accident. All it does is raise the amount that they have to pay to bring it more in line with what today's wages are that people hopefully are earning. And I bring to the committee's attention, it's not unusual to see a mortgage, people paying mortgages that are $1,200 or over per month. $1,250 a month simply will not keep a family going. And what the suggestion in the bill and our suggestion is you raise it up to $3,500 a month. Again, we're not asking to raise the limits, which will allow someone who is unable to work to keep their household going while they get back on their feet so they can go back to work. The next increase in the bill is Section 1D, and that increases the maximum amount for payment for funeral expenses. It's currently $2,500. It increases it to $5,000. You cannot bury someone decently for $5,000. I buried a stepson in 1997, and it cost over twice that much, and he was killed in an auto accident, too. We're asking that it be raised to $5,000 for a funeral benefit. And the final change in this bill is to increase the maximum daycare payment from $15 per day to $50 per day, and increase the maximum payable under your policy from $450 to a total of $1,500. Even at $50 a day, that's still below Oregon's mandated minimum wage for an 8-hour day. You can't hire a babysitter for $15 a day. I did some research on these matters, and in 1983, $1,250 is equivalent in today's dollars of $648.75. That's according to Bureau of Labor Statistics, Department of Commerce. Today, to equal $1,250, you'd have to have at least $2,400 a month in payments. We're asking that the wage payments be raised to $3,500 per month maximum.
Okay, your testimony? Thank you. Mr. Jackson, you referred to 1980, but please.
Yes.
We're not done with you.
Okay.
You asked that, you made a number of references to 1983. Is that to indicate that that was the last time that these rates were set?
To the best of my researching ability, the bill numbers were changed. I know they weren't changed after 91, and I know another bill before you today, the maximum liability limits was changed in 1983. That's the last time it was changed. So as far as I can research and find out, I think it was 83 when these were put in place.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Jackson? Okay, thank you very much. We're going to kind of go rotate here a little bit. So let's call John Powell next, please. Oh, no. Yeah, John. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, before you today representing State Farm Insurance Companies. I'm handing out a copy of the bill that we have modified in terms of offering up some form of compromise on this issue. And before I do that, I've listed on the bottom of the cover page seven areas that the bill either covers or I thought would be instructive to go over at this hearing. Most of them deal with the inside limits that have just been discussed. I think it's important in looking at PIP coverages that you remember in the early 70s when this coverage was put in the law that it was never intended to cover every possible expense in the areas from which reimbursement is provided. In fact, only 14 states have mandatory PIP coverages. Most states either have mandatory offerings that the consumer can turn down because they believe it's duplicative coverage to disability insurance, life insurance, and other forms of coverage. And in states like Colorado, they repealed it last year because the expenses got so high that consumers couldn't afford to continue to purchase automobile insurance. So they eliminated the PIP coverage and went to just a medical coverage. And it's been discussed with you, this last session, we did increase the PIP minimum coverage to $15,000 per policy. That means everybody who purchases an automobile insurance policy in Oregon must purchase at least that amount. And this is a required coverage in the policy. But you can buy more, and many people do, because the PIP coverage covers you and passengers in your car. But to the a lot of people, the medical coverage, if they have health insurance, does reach a point of being duplicative coverages. The loss of income benefit that has been discussed, we would argue, should not be changed. And the I think it was 1989 that it was last increased to this level. The $1,250 limit would cover somebody making about $11 an hour, which would totally basically replace their income. We believe that people, if you get to $3,500, that's the equivalent, that's 70% of a $60,000 a year income. And we believe that in most cases, people who are making that have either sick leave, disability coverages, or other methods of paying for that. So if you significantly increase this coverage, in essence what happens is low-income people pay higher premiums for coverages of people who are making more and in many cases have sick leave and other types of benefit. So again, going back to my original comments, these coverages are not meant to replace disability insurance for people. They are meant as temporary stopgap payments to get to help people out in times of an automobile accident, but not totally replace the need for other forms of insurance. Also on that same page, if you turn to the second page of the printed copy of the bill, you'll see we redlined an area in the middle, or maybe in a couple of the cases it's blue line. I don't know how to work computers either, and for some reason it printed half of them red and half of them blue, and I have no idea. But in adjudicating these claims, one of the things that's problematic, there is also a section in here where remuneration is paid to people who are not, I mean, the benefit is paid to people who are not working or receiving remuneration. And many times a family member will start performing certain services and applying for benefits under PIP. Again, we don't think that was the original intent of the law. We thought it was if people had to go out and hire somebody and pay money, then they would be reimbursed, and that is that suggested language in subsection C in the middle of that page. Going on down that page, we get to the funeral benefit level, and we agree that the $5,000 level would be appropriate. Again, not that that would pay for a full funeral, but the costs of funerals have escalated. When it comes to the child care benefit, we would suggest a $25 per day instead of the larger amount, 50, I believe, called for in the bill, with a cap of $750 as opposed to the $450. And then on the final page, Mr. Chairman and members, we would also suggest that the PIP statute include a fraud section so that there would be no obligation for an insurer to pay when somebody makes false statements in order to collect benefits. And again, that's simply without something like that in the law, it makes it very difficult to adjudicate claims when kind of upon a fraudulent situation. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Powell, thank you. In your suggestions here in the bill, and by the way, I always appreciate people making suggestions of any kind, because as opposed to just being for or against something, it doesn't really help the committee too much sort out all the issues. But it would seem to, and correct me if my assumption is wrong, but even in your analysis here, it does seem on behalf of your client to recognize that there are some inflationary issues here that are fair to be addressed. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there are, and as we noted in the funeral benefit and the daycare benefit and that sort of thing, it is, again, we think that the amount of reimbursement under the disability portion, however, would not, given the increase in costs that would generate, would not bring a subsequent additional benefit to the average insured.
Questions for Mr. Powell? Senator Starr.
Thank you. Just a little bit curious how the market works in this particular arena. You mentioned that a consumer could ask for higher benefits in his insurance. Is that a regular practice? I mean, or does when the agent comes in and knocks on the door and he slaps it in front of me and says, this is it? And I mean, in real terms, is a consumer educated enough or knowledgeable enough to really dig beyond what he sees as this way, kind of what we're seeing in front of us here, and dig into these other issues and say, well, shoot, $15 for childcare. My goodness, I'm paying, you know, $45 a day today. How's that, you know, can I have that lift raised or look at these other things? Is that really does that conversation really occur?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, I think in most cases agents are extremely careful when going over benefit levels with consumers because they fear errors and omissions charges if there is a serious accident and they're at minimum limits. Many times that becomes a question as to why did somebody discuss at higher limits. So in many cases, I think, and in most cases, I know with State Farm insureds, many of them buy higher limits because their agents counsel them as to the benefits of higher limits. So I think in most cases, agents do have those types of discussions with their insureds. I know some companies are better than others at following up. I can't remember what State Farm calls it, but your checkup, I think, where periodically they want to sit down with you, and that's why they do. Your situations may have changed, and they wanted to keep their policies up to date.
Other questions for Mr. Powell? Thank you very much. Let's bring up Lana Butterfield and Sean Miller.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Property and Casualty Insurers Association of America, PCI. It's an association of property casualty insurance companies with more than 300 member companies doing business in the state of Oregon. Just wanted to express some concern. However, given Mr. Powell's amendments on balancing the inflationary benefits that the chair mentioned with increased costs to those that are least able to afford it. Those are the items that our companies are evaluating. And again, we're just willing to work with the committee and look at Mr. Powell's amendments and as we go forward. I think, Mr. Chair, I'll save my comments on the increase of costs for the next bill, Senate Bill 336. And so if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Okay. Any questions? Discussion? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lana Butterfield. I'm here today representing Safeco Insurance Company. Our PIP manager was planning to come down and wasn't able to, but I have provided you with written testimony. One thing I would point out is a suggestion that they have made at the very bottom of the last major paragraph where she says, If the benefits are raised, we propose a higher deductible. So that's something that the committee might like to consider. That's found in on the bill, page 2, would be section 1. It's line 9 in that section.
Okay. Any questions? Don't leave. I've got a question. So I would be curious, Ms. Butterfield, in your written testimony, you talk about, you say specifically this could result in a financial impact on the general public. You know, I'm very curious. Can you tell me what is the average increase of policies by Safeco in the last year as opposed to those same policies the year before? Your average consumer, how much more they're paying for the same coverage that they did the year before?
Mr. Chair, I can't. I wish Rhonda were down here, but I will ask her and get back to you.
Yeah, I would like very much like that. Mr. Miller, what about you, those companies you represent?
Mr. Chair, I represent a trade association, so I could ask specifics of the companies from year to year. Let me clarify. You're asking for the same coverage as...
What the average policyholder of coverages A, B, and C are paying last year for member companies as opposed to what they paid the year before. I mean, I could ask the insurance commissioner, but I would love to hear specifically from some of the companies.
Mr. Chair, I'll provide that to the committee.
See, because one of my issues here is, and I think it's really important for all of us, is that anytime we deal with something with insurance, I'm always hearing people so concerned about the consumers if they have to pay 3% more, 4% more, and I think all of us know, our insurance, that the companies forget other things by government, raise their own rates for their own coffers on me and others on a regular basis. I mean, my homeowner's insurance went up 72% last year. For what? You know, yet they're so concerned about a 3% increase for this or that, but they seem to have no concern for just going ahead and raising cost of doing business. I don't know, automobile rates. I don't know about my colleagues here, but they go up on a regular basis, and the coverages continue to go down. More things are omitted, and the costs go up. And so sometimes I just have a very cynical view about how concerned the insurance industry is for the cost on me as a consumer when every time I open the envelope it's a significant increase and I have absolutely no recourse. And that's why I'd be very curious to see what those are. Other questions or comments? Okay, thank you. And then the last person I have set to testify on this bill is Mike Kolbeck. Welcome. State your name, please.
My name is Mike Kolbeck. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm here on behalf of one of my clients who is medically unable to be here. I got a call a couple hours ago. She couldn't make it, so I'm testifying on her behalf. The situation she is in is she was struck by a drunk driver driving the wrong way down the freeway, suffered severe injuries, is currently trying to live off her PIP coverage of $1,250 a month. Can't work, will not be able to work for a couple of years. And as a result of the drunk driver's actions, she has lost her home, doesn't have a car, doesn't have a phone. And $1,250 a month does not go very far for her. And there's drunk only had a $25,000 policy. And I think I would differ with the testimony you heard about whether you can purchase a $1,250 a month or a $3,000 a month PIP coverage. I think there's only one policy available. And the insurance industry, you could speak differently, but you buy your insurance, I don't think you get to choose the amount of wage loss you'll get per month and buy different plans at different costs. I think you're stuck with one wage loss amount, take it or leave it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a question for you. Push back a little bit on the other side. We've heard testimony and written testimony that the PIP coverage is not intended to be a total replacement of costs, that it is only one of an element of coverages and benefits that as citizens we need to take in mind, disability insurance, medical insurance, etc. And you mentioned your client, they can't live off the PIP coverage, but what they're saying is that we're buying this and for the rate that we're providing it for, it's not intended to be a total replacement of your immediate and ongoing needs.
I would agree with that to some extent, but you just have to look at the pure economics of what 1250 was in 1983 versus what it is today. We're getting a lot less coverage, and the rates go up every year, like you pointed out earlier. If they want to make it a realistic amount, clearly whatever legislative purpose exists in 1983 still exists today. Why should it not be a proportionate amount?
Okay. Questions for Mr. Kohlbach? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does anybody else at this time wish to testify on Senate Bill 151? If not, we will talk about this later. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 151 and open a public hearing. Is he here? Oh, there he has arrived. In this case, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 336. Ask that Senator Charlie Ringo come forward, please. You certainly may.
I have some constituents on this one, but I want to hear this.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Senator Charlie Ringo, and I'm not going to do too good of a job talking today, so all I really want to do is introduce the issue and introduce Neil Jackson. He's already testified before you, but this bill is in a similar vein, and that's the intention is to try to bring to current what the dollar amounts are that are written into our vehicle insurance statutes. And really, all I want to say is that these issues affect real people in very tangible ways who rely on these benefits. You just mentioned, Senator Metzger, that you know people buy a certain amount expecting a certain amount, and I think that's exactly right. The industry may say, well, you're going to raise the limits. It's hard to evaluate those claims, but I can tell you that people really rely on the benefits that are set forth in these insurance policies, and we've got to keep them current with costs out there. And I just appreciate your committee, Mr. Chair, hearing the bills, and I'll let Neil Jackson explain more specifics. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Jackson, welcome again.
Thank you. Again, I'm Neil Jackson. I'm on the Board of Governors of the Oregon Trial Lawyers, here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 336. There's three changes, specific changes in this bill. The first and probably most important change is we currently have a situation where the minimum limits required under Oregon's financial responsibility law for liability coverage is $25,000 per person, $50,000 per accident. The change would be that this bill would require that minimum limits would go $50,000 per person, $100,000 per accident. The second section of the bill provides that if someone has been convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants, they will be required to have a minimum of $100,000 per person, $200,000 per accident. The current law requires that they have $50 per person, $100 per accident. Finally, the third section of the bill provides that certified commercial driver training schools will be required to have 100, 200. These are the schools that train people to drive the big rigs. You see them driving down the road, they got the signs on them, driver in training. Again, let's talk about the inflation factor. Based on the statistics from the Department of Commerce, in 1983, which was when the current limits were established, the coverage is $25,000. In today's dollars, the coverage is $48,169. That's the coverage we need now to equal what it was in 1983. And that, I want to point out that the committee is based on factoring in medical costs at only 6%. That is not the real increase in medical costs since 1983. I couldn't come up with the 1983 stat, but I did come up with what it would cost now to buy $25,000 worth of medical services and goods. In 1975, that would now cost $182,825. Now, the years aren't the same, but we've got a big inflation factor going in, going into this. This is Oregon consumers need to have this coverage. $25,000 in today's economy is simply not enough money. And I will tell the committee, I've been doing auto injury cases for over 26 years.
I cannot recall a case where we did not have to take some of the funds that were received from the at-fault driver's insurance policy and use those funds to pay off medical bills that were not covered by the PIP coverage of the person who was injured. It happens almost every time. We have to use funds, liability funds, to pay off bills that PIP did not cover. So I would urge the committee to support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Question, Mr. Jackson. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm surprised consumers haven't come here. Instead, it's the trial lawyers, so I have a sort of a personal question. When an award is given to a client that you're representing, what cut do you guys get? And if there is someone who died and there's $100,000, you get a cut, a percentage amount. It may vary. I'm naive, don't know anything about attorney fees. Haven't had to use an attorney.
You're lucky. Mr. Chair, Senator Sanderson, thank you. Seeing attorneys like seeing a doctor. You have to do it because something's wrong, and you'd rather not have to do it in the first place. On most injury cases, they are contingent fee because people would rather not be paying at an hourly rate. Most lawyers are happy to do it either way. They can say, I can charge you an hourly rate if that's the fee structure you'd want, or we can do this on a percentage basis, and there's advantages to both ways. The typical percentage basis on an auto injury case is a third. If it goes all the way to a jury trial, it may go up to 40%. It depends on the specific agreement. So it's generally a third. And again, most clients, I think, like to do it on a contingent fee basis. That way they don't get a bill every month in the mail and they're not worried about, I'm making a phone call. How much is this call going to cost me? I think you will hear from consumers. I think this is definitely a consumer issue. I think it's attorneys that are more focused on how this impacts people on a day in, day out basis. But you'll definitely hear from consumers.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. Senator Deckard, I'd like to recognize next. He has a couple of individuals he would like to bring forward. Welcome.
Mr. Chair. Ryan Deckert, unincorporated Washington County, not the city of Beaverton, but I represent the city of Beaverton.
They'll get you soon.
And this is not my auto insurance policy right in front of us, just for the viewing audience. Senator Montes Anderson, you asked for consumers, and we drafted this bill, Senate Bill 336, because the gentleman that is seated to my left, Mr. Rhodes, contacted my office. And this is one of those rare intersections where you have legislation that comes from someone who's been directly affected, and he contacted me about 3 or 4 months ago about a situation that is very similar to the discussion that we have been having this afternoon. He's been in a very, very bad car accident, and a great deal to him and his family, physical and financial harm. And the first time that I heard his story, it was certainly a compelling case of a citizen that needed at least some legislative attention to a situation that we've been discussing this afternoon. This bill would have saved him. So we helped draft Senate Bill 336 because it would have helped save him a great deal of pain and suffering. The bill, as discussed previously, raises car insurance minimums in Oregon, addressing the serious issue of underinsurance. It does it $50,000 for personal and $100,000 for aggregate. And I would like to turn it over to Mr. Rhodes so that he can talk about the situation that he encountered about a year ago on a highway in Central Oregon.
Welcome, Mr. Rhodes.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Eric R. Rhodes, and I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to hear my oral testimony here today. I'm here to testify for my brother Thomas Rhodes and Mr. Donald Schumann, who could not attend this hearing due to medical complications, and myself. The three of us were critically injured in an almost fatal car wreck last September 4th, 2004. Our injuries were massive and for myself almost fatal at one point I was told I had died in the hospital emergency room surgeons were trying to treat me for my injuries. My written testimony, I present my case for supporting both Senate Bill 336 and Senate Bill 461. Our injuries were, to say the least, catastrophic. It is a miracle that all three of us survived this wreck at all. The current legislation for both bodily injury insurance premiums is so woefully inadequate to protect the motoring public here in Oregon, as is the case in such injuries such as ours. The fact of the matter is, the state's already strained public assistance health care system will end up having to pay for much of the bills. That which is not covered will then result in us filing bankruptcy, which impacts, again, the rest of the health care system costs for all Oregonians. These proposed bills are not going to do either Mr. Donald Schuman or my brother Tom or myself any good. But my being here today is to lend support to both bills. However, in any case, proposed bills would never be enough to truly limit the state's liability financially in such horrible automobile collisions. I came here not today for my brother or my friend Don or myself, but to help in any way I can to help prevent economic hardship for similarly injured in the future. I wish to present my written testimony as the time allotted in this forum today is not enough to allow my presentation orally. I truly believe my state will drive home the obvious need to change the laws on requirements for bodily injury liability insurance here in the state of Oregon. Our medical bills for the three of us to date come out at over $500,000 for the three of us, and they're still rapidly rising at this time. I ask that the committee please support both Senate Bill 336 and Senate Bill 461. I wish to thank once again each and every one of you for hearing our case, for raising the mandatory automobile insurance requirements here in Oregon. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. I have a couple questions for you. In your accident, were you determined at fault, or was it the other vehicle?
I wasn't driving. I was a passenger.
I know, but was it your vehicle or the other vehicle?
I was a passenger in the vehicle, and the other vehicle was found at fault. It took 5 months to get a very thorough case study done by the Deschutes County Sheriff's Department and State CART Crash Accident Reconstruction Team. And three officers have signed written statements to the effect that the other party was 100% at fault. She admitted at the scene of the accident or shortly thereafter during the investigation phase that she had a neurological condition also known as attention deficit disorder, was taking Adderall and amphetamine-based medication on top of Clonopin, which is a type of benzodiazepine similar to Xanax and Valium medication. On top of that, she was taking an antidepressant also known as Wellbutrin. I think this kind of use of these psychoactive drugs and then operating a motor vehicle poses a huge risk. I have filed a complaint formally with the DMV, and there is a medical exam being performed on this person as to whether she should continue to drive. She was less than a half mile from her home when this wreck occurred. I would say anyone who can't focus long enough on the task of driving to go a half mile to their driveway is clearly not someone who should be driving given the medical circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And that whole general issue is, apart from this one, I think is of a lot of concern to people in this assembly. I know some number of people in the Senate are working on various issues affecting the use of drugs and how they impact other parts of our life, as this one has. Mr. Rhodes, was this lady insured? In other words, were you able to collect from her insurance? Was she uninsured? Or was it your insurance that had to pick up the whole tab?
She was horribly underinsured. We're having to go against my brother's uninsured portion of his insurance automotively to pick up a good balance of the bills. But that's only $50,000 per person per accident. And she had $100,000 maximum liability, which places her maximum exposure at $33,000 approximately apiece, which... Well, let's do the math, folks. It's $83,000. I have over $110,000 myself right now, and that's not done. Mm-hmm. So my exposure financially, the risk to me, and I haven't received any time loss yet. I haven't been recompensed for any of my pharmaceuticals or even this collar I'm wearing right now. So the damages to me have been great. My brother is permanently disabled for life. He has difficulty speaking. He obviously has some paralysis on the right side of his body, the right arm, the right leg, and the shattered right ankle, which apparently needs to be fused permanently to proceed with his further recovery. My good friend Don Schuman received over 20 major fractured bones in his body, both legs below the knees, his pelvis in four places, his right hip, His right arm was shattered, his right collarbone, four broken ribs, and on top of that, he has developed an abscess as a complication of the repetitive surgeries on his right arm, and they have to get that under control, or he may have to lose the arm due to the possible life-threatening spread of this infection. He could not be here today due to those complications. So we're looking at close, you figure my brother's injuries for life and disability, we're looking at, he's 48. He has possibly 35, maybe up to 40 years of life ahead of him. Who knows? In any case, this is substantial and it's monumental. I'll get over my injuries. I have to have a $20,000 surgery to repair my internal organs that were ruptured. I was bleeding to death internally at the scene of the accident. I can tell you personally that it's the most unsettling experience I've ever had in my life. No, I was dying right there. The other driver, as I've said, suffered from some medical conditions that were under medication, and I question whether that should have even been why her physician did not report her to the state. I have yet to find out if that is true, whether she was or not. But under Oregon Revised Statute 807.710, the form clearly states from the DMV that physicians are required to report attention disorders. As if a person cannot stay focused while behind the wheel, they surely do not belong behind the wheel.
Mr. Rhodes, one other question. I'll open up the committee for questions. You talked about your cumulative bills so far over $500,000 in medical costs, and certainly the coverages have not covered that. So who is picking up the majority of those costs right now? Those dollars are being absorbed by who?
Well, actually, we're going to the Oregon Health Plan, Social Security, the OMPA, or Oregon Medical Health Plan. Mm-hmm. OPA or whatever that's called. So we have the we have a whole fraction of options that we're applying for benefits for, and we have no choice but to. And our last relief would be, of course, bankruptcy. For me, that means I'll probably never own a home. I'm 48, and because of that being on my record, by the time bankruptcy comes off my credit record, I'm 58, almost what, 7 years from retirement, or nearly 10 at the most. Not going to be possible. Not in my lifetime.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. Questions from the committee? Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Thank both of you for coming. Since the time of the accident in September, you've had to deal with a whole myriad of insurance companies. Can you briefly describe what that experience has been like? Have you felt that it's been timely? Can you feel like they've attended to your needs, or did you feel guilty and you had to prove your innocence when you're dealing with the insurance company?
I felt nothing but resistance, fighting, defending their profits over my pain and my brother's pain and my friend Don's pain. None of us been compensated as of yet. My brother has been able to get some time loss from his own insurance company for PIP, but at $1,250 a month with his kinds of bills, which I have not even been able to calculate his bills because I haven't got all the documents to do so. It's in my written report. These are like probably multi-million dollar damages. I mean, we almost all died. I have a photograph that's in my written testimony of the Honda motor car we were in, and you can't even tell what kind of car it was anymore. That's how shredded this automobile was. The other party was driving an SUV, so you might guess what kind of devastating impact that was between the two vehicles. It was over 100 miles an hour. I have been exasperated and frustrated with this whole thing. It has tortured me. I cannot tell you how much, every night of every day, all day long, too. If it wasn't for my family's support right now, I don't know how I'd make it.
Any questions? Thank you very much for taking the time to share your story with us, and we will look at your material. Thank you very, very much.
I also support this PIP coverage bill, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I'm going to ask that Teresa Anderson and Mike Kolbeck both come up at the same time.
Are you going to have insurance companies come back?
Yes. I'm looking to pinch
you. You're a nurse. You can.
Welcome. And since you have an opportunity already, we will start with, is it Teresa?
Yeah.
Yeah. Welcome. Thanks for coming. State your name and talk to us.
My name is Teresa Anderson, and I strongly support SB 336. June 12th, of 2004, one of my friends was driving my car with my best friend in the back seat. I honestly really don't remember how we got into the accident. I lost all memory of that. But we were driving at high speed, supposedly. I found out. And he crashed into a telephone pole. He went around a corner at like some 80 miles an hour, crashed into a telephone pole, knocked the transformer box down onto the car, blew up the car, and set the car on fire, broke both of my legs, injured my best friend, sent me to the hospital for 3.5 weeks, about that, three and a half weeks, somewhere in there. Needless to say, my medical expenses right now are at $170,000, about that, just from the hospital stay, surgery, medical like equipment, like the rod in my leg, everything, and medical bills are still going up because I'm still going through therapy, I'm still going through x-rays, I still have all that stuff that I'm doing. So my medical expenses at the end are probably going to be somewhere around like $200,000, maybe even more, just mine alone. That's not counting my best friends. The driver was uninsured. His mom, he was a minor at the time, his mom didn't have insurance on her car. So my insurance company had to pick up all the expenses, and what they're not picking up, personally, we're having to pick up. We're having to do payments on. So the $25,000 limit, you know, that was maybe a half a night for me the first day in the hospital with my expenses. That was like not even my surgery. So I support raising it up to higher limits because the $25,000, that's not enough for anybody these days for expenses. That covers hardly anything. And like in my case, the uninsured, because I was with an uninsured driver, it sends it to be like your problem. Now you have to pick up all the expenses. And my family doesn't have that kind of money at all. I played sports. I can't do that anymore. I'm not, well, I mean, I can, but not as well as I used to be. I lost my scholarships. I'm only a junior in high school, and I already had scholarships lined up to go to college for soccer, and those are gone now. So I completely support SB 336.
Thank you, Teresa. You may have some questions. I'll ask Mr. Colbeck, though, to make his comments first.
Hi, Chair, committee members. A client I spoke about earlier, Elizabeth Parr, was hit by a drunk driver. I believe it was her fourth DUI conviction. She's doing 70 months in prison, but that doesn't help my client out at all. Over the years, I see a lot of drunk drivers. Obviously, they cause a lot of accidents and serious accidents, and the vast majority of them have a $25,000 policy because they buy the cheapest insurance they can get away with. If they could buy a $5,000 policy, they would. I think these people are a very dangerous group of drivers, and I'm sure their insurance rates reflect that, but we need to be protected. I think they should have the higher minimum for people with a previous DUI conviction to protect the innocent people who get hit by them. That happens all the time.
Questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. Thank you both very much for coming. Thank you, Chris. John Powell and Sean Miller, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean, could you hand those in? Thank you for allowing us a chance to testify today. Mr. Chairman, if I might, on a couple points that have been discussed by the committee at this time, I'd simply like to make a couple observations. One, the issue of insurance rates. Insurance rates are predicated upon losses and adjusted according to loss data and loss trends. So the same number of accidents, if State Farm had the same number of accidents this year that they had last year, the same level of destructiveness, they would could well pay 8% more than they paid for the same accidents the year earlier. And I just wanted to make sure that the committee understood that how those rates are developed on cost trends. And in medical coverages, I think we all know what that trend is. So actually buying the same amount of coverage does cost more each year, and I just wanted to put that on the record. The second thing, if I understand the coverage levels of the witnesses that have preceded me, the bill before you, Senate Bill 336, would not apply. In the one case, you had an uninsured driver. Obviously, the limits wouldn't apply to that person. And from the sounds of it, in the other case where the wrongdoer had $100,000 in liability coverage and they're collecting from their underinsured motorist coverage, they had to have more UM coverage than that. So the basis of this bill would not have applied in either one of those examples. I've handed you a copy of testimony and two charts which show the mandatory bodily injury limit levels by each state. The first is a chart which shows those levels on a per-person basis, and secondly is a chart which shows each state and their limits of liability. And as you can see, Oregon is with the majority of states higher than some, but the minimum coverages are equal to those of all states except four states. Did I identify myself? I forgot.
Well, go ahead and get just in case we forgot who you were.
I'm Denny Crane. my name is John Powell. Before you, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. State Farm does not believe it is wise to increase the minimum automobile insurance premiums at this time. Oregon has an uninsured driver population of between 12% and 14%. The primary reason citizens drive without insurance is the cost of insurance. To increase the cost of the minimum amounts of insurance will likely lead to even more uninsured drivers. And Mr. Chairman, I don't have it today, but we will supply the committee with a chart comparing states around us that have higher insurance costs, and that will show very clearly that the uninsured rate in those states is higher simply because of the premium costs in those states, and they have a higher uninsured driver population. Most State Farm insured drivers already carry liability limits higher than the minimum. Only about 25,000 State Farm drivers would experience a 7% rate increase with the passage of Senate Bill 336. That increase translates into an average of $20 per year for policyholders in the preferred category and an average of $30 per year for those in the standard rated company. However, this is not the population of drivers who are prone to driving without insurance. For drivers who have multiple tickets or accidents, the increase in auto liability rates will be much, much greater. Drivers protect themselves against loss due to underinsured drivers by purchasing increased uninsured motorist coverage. The amount of uninsured motorist coverage a policyholder carries that exceeds the liability limits of the at-fault driver becomes underinsured motorist coverage, as we've heard from previous witnesses. That is to say, a State Farm policyholder who purchases $100,000 of UM coverage will be able to collect from their own insurance company the difference between the recovery of the policy limits of the party at fault and their total claim up to that limit of $100,000. In essence, you can buy protection against those situations where people you meet on the highway are underinsured. You have the charts, and I will supplement this testimony in writing to you with the other information.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. Well, Mr. Dylan Miller testify, and then we'll have questions.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America, PCI. Is an association of property casualty insurance companies with more than 300 member companies doing business in the state of Oregon. As John indicated, PCI also has a position to oppose Senate Bill 336 because of the cost, the increases of cost for people who have trouble affording the insurance in the first place. If the bill passed, the likely result for many in the state is that they will go uninsured rather than pay that increase. John indicated that the rate of uninsured motorists in Oregon is somewhere up in the rounds of 14%, and the state is ranked about 23rd highest in the nation. The question before the Senate Business Committee is, does the state want to aspire to be higher in this category when it is a policy of the state of Oregon for everyone to have auto insurance? As John indicated, currently about 25 states have the minimum limits, which are the same as Oregon limits. There is about 10 states with slightly lower limits than Oregon has currently on the books, and a few that have several that are just slightly above the limits. As you can see, most of the states have settled on these levels of coverage, and only two states have gone to the levels that are indicated in the bill or proposed in the bill, and that's Alaska and Maine. And Mr. Chair, I would like to make a correction on the fourth paragraph of my written testimony. It says that those states are Alaska and Massachusetts, and it's Alaska and Maine. I made a mistake on my northeast states, and so I want to, for the record, correct that statement. In conclusion, Mr. Chair, what I wanted to do with some of the companies is get an increase or proposed increase, and so I asked different companies what would the increase be under the proposed bill. And as John indicated, the good drivers aren't the ones that drop off. It's the folks that have one or two violations. The demographics are more of are worse in urban areas. They're actually more. Tend to be lower income individuals and young adults. And I say that because the perfect demographic of the classic case of somebody that decides to go uninsured is somebody under 25 years of age. And it's the average male or male 24 years of age who has one violation, one of the companies that writes high-risk policies, their rates would go up about $120 a year. If they have a couple violations, $140 a year. A family of four from another company, and this is a family of four with no tickets, would go up approximately $280 a year, and on and on. I think it, based on the number of violations, or if you add an accident to those violations, that even goes up higher. And so I just want to point out that those are the examples of the folks that will go uninsured if you pass the bill and create the increase in premium, and we are concerned about that. And Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and would respectfully ask the committee to oppose Senate Bill 336.
Okay, thank you. I have a couple questions. Either one of you would like to chime in on this. It was pointed out earlier in testimony that under the current rate, taking, for example, the $25,000 floor for bodily injury or death of a person in an accident, that at least from 1983 to today, that would be an equivalent in today's buying power of $48,000, pretty much approximating the $50,000 that has been suggested in the bill. Now, I don't have I can't independently verify the inflation rate, but that would sound rather reasonable. I was curious as to your take as to why these coverages shouldn't keep up with inflation, because I could feel pretty confident that if I went back to my 83 auto policy, that coverage cost me in dollars of 83 less dollars than I'm being charged now for that same amount of coverage. And wouldn't it make sense to have inflationary protection just as the company takes inflationary measures every year to raise the prices?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Denny Crane,
What was your first question?
Well, the question is that the cost of the policy will go up every year, but the mm-hmm. cost of coverage does not. Okay. And yet, the value in today's dollars is diminishing while the cost yeah. continues to increase. And my question would be, why wouldn't those run in parallel? That the cost of the policy would also be reflected in an inflation cost of the coverage provided.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the cost of the policy reflects the amount of claims that were tendered in previous years and an actuarial understanding of what that trend is. So the average PIP claim or the average BI claim right now is about $9,000. And there, as I think the testimony today has pointed out, there's no way to cover the extremes. And again, we get back to the need to have health insurance and other coverages for those extreme outlier cases. The current levels of coverage does cover well the average claim. So it is the frequency of claims, so that if you have $109,000 claims this year and you have $159,000 claims next year, your frequency increases. Instead of costing $9,000 next year, it might be $9,500. And if the cost of those claims gets to the point where it does bump these limits, then I think a reflection on that would be appropriate, and then charging everybody more to buy more coverage. But when you have an uninsured rate like we do, and evidence that cost is the determinant factor, again, it's a juggernaut, because then you're going to have more instances of people driving without insurance. And people without insurance, one of the reasons we hear so many stories about those is they tend to be worse drivers, and they do get into more accidents. So the more of those you put on the road, the more people who have no coverage are approaching you. So it is a balancing act.
Let me follow up with that comment about more uninsured on the road. Obviously, the company isn't going out and checking individuals for their certificate of insurance. So who is the primary gatekeeper of drivers to make sure they have insurance or not?
Mr. Chairman, in order to get certain license renewals and that sort of thing, I believe you have to prove that you have insurance. Obviously, the police now, through the LED system, insurance companies are required to report their policies to DMV, which in turn are put into that system, so that when a check is made by a patrolman, their insurance is supposed to show up, or whether they're uninsured is supposed to show up. Companies are required to provide evidence of insurance, so people pack the card. Short of expending millions and millions of dollars a year, it's just impractical to be able to make sure people don't cancel policies that they've purchased in order to get license renewals and those sorts of things, or to keep them from borrowing a car. All kinds of situations arise. So we do spend quite a bit of money reporting all of this data by serial number to DMV, and they in turn into the system. So that's the system Oregon has in terms of trying to minimize the number of uninsured drivers.
Well, I think if I follow up, I think you make the point is that the point of contact, as you mentioned, primarily would be the police, the state patrol, checking to make sure that you're insured, and then they have options to do that. So would it be fair to say that since we have less state patrol people out there, there are less people being checked and potentially more uninsured drivers costing consumers, companies, more money? Would that be an accurate...
That's a possibility, yes, no. if they're highway patrol.
My final question, I'll ask members of the committee. Here's one that does bother me a little bit. Section 2 is raising the requirements for those who have been convicted of DUIs. Now, I understand that trade-off. You say, well, if you rate it too much, they're not going to get it. The same standpoint, they've already established themselves as a tremendous risk, not only to the company, but to everyone else. I'd like to hear your rationale as to why there should be not stronger requirements there, and then double checks on those people, since we've identified that particular group of individuals.
Mr. Chairman, I don't, I mean, I, that's a separate policy issue in my judgment, where the state wants to look at somebody who's violated the law to that degree of seriousness as to whether you want to increase that, yeah, I think is a separate policy issue and one that's fair game.
Where would State Farm be on that? A requirement that to ensure these individuals that they increase that portion?
Well, if you have a Dewey, I don't think State Farm's your market.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, that would not affect this company.
Okay, should have a high risk.
Yeah.
Market.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I can check with some of our companies. We do have some companies that are our minimum limit companies, and I'll check on the increase. I know there's a dramatic increase in premium if it's raised, if that person has a Dewey, but it's a question I can pose to the group.
Okay. I mean, it's an interesting conundrum. Mm-hmm. You want them to have coverage, but at the same standpoint, you also want to make sure, since they are a higher risk to everyone, including themselves, that the coverage is adequate.
Yeah.
Questions from the committee for any of these gentlemen? Senator Montes Henderson.
Thank you. And I think you might have been answering the questions. I just need more clarification.
Am I having the same kind of day?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I understand the premiums going up and how you determine that. But when was the last time that the bodily injury was less? I believe many years ago it used to be $10,000 and now it's $25,000. I was just wondering if
we'll have to get that.
That law many, many years ago. I can't remember.
I can't even remember the question that was just asked of me.
Okay.
So if it was more than an hour ago.
It's a nice day outside.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate knowing that. But we will get that for you.
Okay.
Senator Decker, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I realize this is a difficult issue, but it's a pretty serious one also. And that's what I'm just trying to wrestle with. And Mr. Miller, you suggested, or you said to the committee, that the question on the table, which is one of the questions on the table, is how much the cost of insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But the other question that I think is before us, and the salient one, is what is the solution for the gentleman who testified before you and the young lady, and are taxpayers the ultimate backstop? And on these cases, and I don't know if the industry has formulated a formal position of who ought to be the ultimate backstop, whether it's us collectively as auto insurance holders or ultimately if it is the taxpayers of Oregon and America that become the ultimate.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, I don't think we have a position on that quite yet, but I would be obviously interested in posing that to my association. I think, and I don't know all the circumstances in the particular case that was before us, but again, we're willing to work with you on in the committee and figuring that out.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Deckard, again, obviously at some insurance level, In order to price a product, you have to know what the limits of that cost are going to be. And if we took the limits off, as perhaps your question would suggest, and insurance would just pay for anything, then the cost would go up very substantially. And so many in our society who are favored in the tax structure perhaps because of their low income would then be forced to either decide to drive or not drive based on what this cost would be. And then ultimately, if you wanted to put that policy on private auto insurance, it would create, I think, a very difficult situation to work. So I guess that's as good as I could answer that question, and again, unfortunately, not everybody can afford health insurance either, and disability insurance, and all of those things. So there are always going to be those costs that any kind of a purchased insurance product isn't going to quite meet. If people die accidentally, even though they may have life insurance, it may not be enough for their family. So those situations I don't have an answer for those.
Mr. Chair.
Let Senator Decker finish here.
And it's more, and I understand the hydraulics that are in place in terms of when coverage goes up or when the price of coverage goes up. But I do think it's interesting, and I don't know if a work group on these two bills is kind of in play here, because you have two similar nature bills. But I do think it's an interesting question that for us as policymakers, but also for the industry, is really what is the ultimate solution for folks that are involved in these cases that obviously no one wants to ever see. But it seems to me we should at least have well thought out solutions, working with our insurance companies to think through how do we deal with these cases, and surveying the states to see if others have found creative ways to find solutions for those real tough extreme cases.
Senator Starr had a question, then back to Senator Montesanders.
Thank you. And my question really follows a similar line as Senator Deckard's. It's that catastrophic case. Is there the ability for folks to kind of buy catastrophic coverage on a person-by-person basis? One, to protect themselves and their families, number one. That's a question. And then the second question is the at-fault party. Is there no other legal remedy that somebody who's been hit or had an accident caused and they're not at fault, is there no other legal remedy that the aggrieved party or the damaged party can go after the at-fault party? I mean, let's make an assumed situation where somebody of means, a wealthy person, is at fault. Does the damaged person not have the ability to go after that quote wealthy person's assets to help make themselves right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, the short answer is yes, and that's why people with large assets pools do insure quite heavily with umbrellas, and to make sure they have adequate coverages to protect against catastrophic losses. And you do have a right to go after the wrongdoer. It's in some cases there's just not much there.
Senator Montesanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to look at the broader question of rate setting by the legislature. Mm-hmm. And we have the PUC, of course, that's public utilities, and they look at utilities as such in one area. But here we are, we're talking about something entirely different. And as a general policy question, has the legislature come up and set rates like this before in the past that you have had to follow? These rates that you have now have been set by the company themselves, or is this something that the legislature has determined?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mona Sanderson, the limits that we're talking about today, the minimum limits, have been established by the legislature. To say this is, number one, you're required by law to have these coverages, liability, and then the so-called no-fault coverages, which includes PIP and uninsured motorists, you're required, everyone in Oregon is required to have that coverage and in order to drive an automobile. So the legislature has established that, and they've said here's the minimum levels that you have to have. The charts that I supplied you show every state in the union that has minimum limits and shows you what those levels are in each state. And as we pointed out, we're at or above most states.
A follow-up? Mm-hmm. Alaska's at 50, and I don't know what you said. Maine, you said, was up there, but I don't see Maine on there. When did they change their limits, or why is their limits so different?
Senator, I'm not sure when they did that.
Recently, in the last 5 years?
Probably hasn't been too long. No.
Alaska was in the sometime early 80s and came from Alaska.
Okay. Okay.
Other questions?
Three, on the material I gave you, shows that three states changed their limits last year. They're in red. And, again, none of those went above our limits. They were lower and moved up to limits.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No one else is set to testify at this time on Senate Bill 336 unless you would like to. If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 336, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 462, our last bill for the day. Ask Sarah Reeder and her contingent from ODF to come forward, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Reeder, here today on behalf of ODS. The ODS Companies is a multifaceted organization that provides dental, medical, and professional liability insurance products, along with a variety of business services, including dental practice management software and benefits administration. ODS is Oregon's oldest dental insurer and currently serves over 600,000 Oregonians with dental and medical insurance. ODS requested Senate Bill 462 be drafted in response to the proposed repeal of the statute pertaining to investments by health care service contractors by the Department of Consumer and Business Services Insurance Division. And we have worked out the details with the Insurance Division, and Senate Bill 462 is the consensus agreement. It is my understanding that this is an acceptable change to other affected health care service contractors, and there is no other opposition. With me today are John Jurevic, Senior VP and Chief Financial Officer for ODS, and Jim Kennedy, Legal Counsel for ODS, to provide you with a more detailed explanation of the bill. Following their testimony, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, committee members. John Jurevic, I'm the Senior VP of Finance and the Chief Financial Officer of the ODS Companies. As Sarah indicated, our principal business is insuring Oregonians medical and dental insurance. Our parent company, Oregon Dental Service, has been in business actually since 1955. Oregon, our other entity that's subject to the law we're talking about today, aside from Oregon Dental Service, is a subsidiary company of ours called ODS Health Plan, Inc. Both Oregon Dental Service and ODS Health Plan, Inc. are health care service contractors that are currently have their investment in subsidiaries controlled by ORS 750-047. We've known for at least over a year of the Insurance Division's intent to repeal 750-047 so that there is essentially a level playing field on the investment in subsidiary rules. Essentially, there's not a preference given to the healthcare service contractors. As it stands right now, healthcare service contractors have a less stringent requirement as far as their investment in subsidiaries, which essentially is a test based on 50% of your capital and surplus. Under 733-630, there's a more stringent requirement. It is essentially the lesser of the 50% of capital and surplus or 10% of admitted assets. In our companies, the situation we would have a problem with is that Oregon Dental Service, the ultimate parent, has made a downstream investment of approximately $17.5 million. And under the current law, at 50% of capital, we have an additional $9 million in capacity to invest in subsidiaries. However, if the 750-047 is repealed and we're subject to 733-630, we would be in violation of the statute because of the limitation based on the percentage of admitted assets. So we would be out of compliance by about $8.5 million. Working with the Insurance Division here, I want to indicate has been terrific to work with on a collaborative effort here. We are supportive of the repeal of 750-047. If we can have the transition rules implemented such that we are not in a violation, and at some point in the future, as explained in the bill, we will be in compliance with all of our new investments. We also thought it was a good opportunity while we are addressing 750-047 to clarify some of the language under 733-630, so to make it more administrable so everybody knows how the rules are played under investment in subsidiaries. With that said, I'll turn it over to our counsel, Jim Kennedy.
Mr. Kennedy, we have written testimony also by Mr. Kennedy here. So,
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, our law firm represents Oregon Dental Service and ODS Health Plan. I, Jim Kennedy, have been legal counsel for ODS for, I guess, 13 years. We have worked very closely with the insurance division to come up with reasonable transition rules for healthcare service contractors, and also to make the necessary clarifications with respect to ORS 733-630, which would then become the same standard for both healthcare service contractors and insurers with respect to their investments in subsidiaries. As Mr. Jurevic indicated, basically the bill does three things. First of all, it repeals ORS 750.047, which is a very favorable provision for healthcare service contractors. And in my written testimony, I've provided you with the implications for Oregon Dental Service, which are significant. Notwithstanding the adverse impact on Oregon Dental Service, it and its subsidiary, ODS Health Plan, are willing to support the bill so long as there are fair transition rules and so long as necessary clarifications are made to ORS 733-630. Briefly, the transition rules would allow healthcare service contractors to continue to apply the old standard, the more flexible standard of ORS 750.047 until January 1, 2009, and that would be on the basis of what its capital and surplus would be as of December 31, 2004. So this transition rule in essence allows these companies several years to adjust to the more restrictive standards, and any investments that have been made in the past as well as during this transition period would be grandfathered. The bill also makes three very necessary clarifications with respect to 733-630. The first thing that it does is that it levels the playing field between insurance subsidiaries and non-insurance subsidiaries. Right now, there are special rules that deal with how you measure an investment in an insurance subsidiary. These same rules would apply to non-insurance subsidiaries. The second change is that the bill permits a return of invested capital to be recognized for purposes of the aggregate limitations in these statutory sections. Right now, ORS 733.630 does not address the question of the return or repayment of invested capital. This bill would allow the investment in subsidiaries to be reduced by any sort of repayment or return. The last clarification is that ORS 733-630 currently does not specify when compliance is measured. This bill would permit or would recognize that compliance with these statutory limitations is measured on the last day of the month immediately preceding when the investment is made. So what would happen is that fluctuations in an insurer's capital and surplus, or in a healthcare service contractor's capital and surplus or assets, would not affect statutory compliance. With these clarifications to ORS 733-630 and with the transition rules, ODS and ODS Health Plan are supportive of the changes set forth in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. So just clarification on this. Obviously, the Department of Consumer and Business Services has these regulations to make sure you have sufficient liquid assets to meet responsibilities of the parent company, which is why they want to be careful about that. Under this legislation, everyone, including the other insurance companies, will operate under the same parameters. And you'll also have the opportunity under this, as well others, that as you recapitalize or recover capital from investments, that'll be deducted from your number that you're willing with, and then able to reinvest that elsewhere.
So. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for the committee, Senator Montesano.
Yeah, I think a follow up on that a little bit. Obviously, ODS made a decision to make these investments because they are lucrative. In your subsidiaries, I mean, you'd made a decision to invest in these subsidiaries. Am I okay?
Yes.
And this isn't going to limit you for not having those subsidiaries. Is that correct? Or are you going to have to get rid of now some of those?
No, no. All of those prior investments will be grandfathered. In essence, okay. What this will do is establish limitations going forward after the transition period is over.
Okay, follow.
So it will relate. Currently, Oregon Dental Service has additional capacity in which it could invest in subsidiaries. This will limit that additional capacity with respect to future investments in subsidiaries.
But, okay, then follow up. So we, in a sense, are tying your hands by making investments that you ordinarily would do, and I'm just curious, as to is that going to hurt you from royalties or revenue or whatever you can get from it?
Well, the impact is adverse on Oregon Dental Service. Yet Oregon Dental Service does recognize the reasons why the Department of Consumer and Business Services wants to treat healthcare service contractors and insurers in the same manner with respect to their investments in subsidiaries. So while the impact is adverse, Oregon Dental Service and ODS Health Plan are willing to support this bill so long as there are reasonable transition rules and so long as the statute that would govern investments in subsidiaries in the future is clarified to deal with these problem areas.
Okay.
I hear a question. Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment that in my short time here, I have never witnessed more citations of ORS. I counted 27, and it's my congratulations to you. 27 citations of ORS in 7 paragraphs. Which is a good model for passing legislation, is to cite ORS 27 times, and I think that's to get your bills passed. I have now taken note of a very good tactic.
Well, I think we'll see that when Senator Deckard marks up a revenue bill on tax compliance. Senator Monis Anderson, and I think your point was well taken and accurate, I think, as the panelists responded. And I think we'll hear from DCBS as our final testimony here from the insurance division and why they want to treat them as insurance companies. They want to make sure certainly that they can invest wherever they want, but if all those go south and everything's invested in it, meanwhile they have obligations to you as an insured to make sure that there is sufficient capital to meet those obligations, and trying to find that balance to allow them to invest but not to put them at undue risk and therefore put those who have purchased their services at risk. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And our final testimony will come from the dynamic duo of the insurance division. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Carl Lemberg. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Insurance Division for the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs and Services, and I'm here today to request your support of Senate Bill 462. Senate Bill 462 applies to both healthcare service contractors, the same standards that apply now to insurance companies. The department initially sought to accomplish this purpose through its own bill, which was Senate Bill 129. In further discussions of that bill, we discovered that there were certain clarifications that needed to be made to the standards governing insurance investments that were, and that the relating clause that we had in Senate Bill 129 was just too narrow to allow for these changes. So we were talking with people that you just heard speak, and we decided that it would be best to support Senate Bill 462 because it includes both the original language of Senate Bill 129 and the needed clarifications that they felt they needed in order to be sure that the playing field was indeed level. Healthcare service contractors are currently subject to a different, less stringent standard for their investments in subsidiaries than insurance companies are. A healthcare service contractor's investment in subsidiaries may not exceed 50% of their capital and surplus, and insurance companies may not exceed 50% of their capital and surplus. or 10% of their admitted assets. Admitted assets are the assets of an insurer that, or a healthcare service contractor may legally report as assets in the financial statement, which is filed with the insurance division. These types of assets are like cash and stocks and bonds and real estate. Healthcare service contractors are corporations such as Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, and ODS, and Kaiser Permanente, and they're usually sponsored by a group of doctors or hospitals, and they accept prepayment for healthcare services. Healthcare service contractors generally conduct their business in a manner similar to commercial insurers, and for that reason are subject to almost all the same laws that apply to commercial insurers. And that's really the impetus of why we want this legislation, because as the first speaker said, we want a level playing field. And these are solvency issues, and these financial regulations really protect the insurance buying public in Oregon, because that way, since the businesses are being run very much the same way, the solvency requirements are being applied the same way. And we are very fortunate not to have had any insolvencies in Oregon for a long time, and that's in part due to the solvency requirements that the legislature has put in place. Senate Bill 462 also makes some technical amendments to ORS 733.630, the statute that governs the insurance company investments. These investments clarify some ambiguities and make explicit the interpretation that the insurance division has used in enforcing the statute. The amendments make clear that the limitation on investments in subsidiaries is determined at the time the investment is made, and that the limitation applies to the net investment made in the subsidiary. You've heard about the phase-in period and so forth, and so I won't belabor that any further. We think that this is a good idea. The healthcare service contractor had been making their business plans with the law that was in place, and by allowing a phase in, they can complete whatever their business plans are. The time period is reasonable, and it has a grandfather provision, so we feel that that is a good part of the bill. We worked with the healthcare service contractors on this legislation to find a solution that meets the public need of assuring the safety and soundness of healthcare service contractors while at the same time meeting their needs. I therefore respectfully request that your support on this bill.
Thank you. Now, the only one that I've had discussion with is with ODS. You mentioned a couple of others. So you had contact with them as well? And
yes, and this actually was a bill that we proposed last session. And there were some things that needed to be fixed on that bill, so it didn't go any farther. And we worked with all the stakeholders that were interested in the bill from last session, and we resolved all of those issues.
I think most of those issues were with ODS last year, correct? I mean,
that's correct.
So, well, I applaud you for working with him. Have more to add? Okay. Thank you. Questions of the department? Well, thank you very much. We will bring this bill back for a work session later. I appreciate working with that and with the industry on this. And members, I will ask Ms. Van Winkle to work with the insurance folks that we spoke earlier to see if there appears to be a few things in there that that we may be able to find some reconciliation on that may be good for the order. I'll ask them to get together and see if that is possible. And with that, we are adjourned.